Hi, I'm Antonia, and I'm a midwife.
Hi, I'm Micah, and I'm a midwife.
Hi, I'm Jane, I'm a midwife.
Hi, I'm Savannah, a student midwife.
Hi, I'm Lucy, and I'm a midwifery support worker.
Hello, my name's Golbano, and I'm a midwife.
Hi, I'm Abby, and I'm a birth centre midwife.
Hi, I'm Jo Tanner, and welcome to the RCM podcast. This month's episode has been recorded in and around the RCM's Education and Research Conference, which took place in Birmingham in March. It was our largest conference yet to solely focus on education and research issues, with over 200 people coming together. What came through loud and clear was that midwifery education doesn't begin and end with a degree. Not only are there a growing number of different ways into the profession, but midwives and MSWs never stop learning. And that applies to educators too. Most modern midwifery careers start with an application to university. That first step on what, for most, is a lifelong journey. In Birmingham, I caught up with Louise Armstrong, a midwife and midwifery educator who's determined to ensure that first step is on solid ground.
What's really on my heart, or what motivates me, in all the years that I've dealt with applicants to midwifery, is that I've really noticed that there's a big gap between what the universities want, what we want applicants to be like when they come for interview, and how prepared we want them to be, and how schools prepare them. And schools are very willing and they do their best, but very often they don't have a real understanding of the real choices in healthcare. So what I've unearthed is they have systems often in place for those students in sixth form that might want to do medical school or law, but they don't have really information on the much wider remit of healthcare. They don't understand that nursing has many specialist roles. They don't understand that midwifery is very different from nursing. They don't understand that you could train as a paramedic, speech therapist, occupational therapist, physiotherapist, osteopath, all of those things. And so I've started some work in the local area with schools to try and involve myself in their careers work with their careers leads to up the profile and give more choices with different healthcare professions. One presentation that I did with a local school that had, I think it was three to five all-female students who wanted to seriously consider midwifery. And I gave them a talk. But what I actually, the slant that I took with them, because they were all applying this particular year, this last admissions round, I told them, gave them all the information that they would need to choose a university. A lot of them were completely unaware that if you, say, went to Manchester University, you might be placed at Withinshaw or Stepping Hill, which is miles away from the centre of Manchester. They hadn't made those connections. And the fact that that's actually very important with any university, they need to know where the clinical placements are. They weren't aware really of the detail that they would have to do shifts, all sorts of things. And they said at the end of it, they would have had no idea where to get that information from, but it was critical to their application.
What surprised Louise was, regardless of how passionate or committed the young people she spoke to were about midwifery as a career, how unprepared they were for the realities of their studies. With such high attrition rates on many undergraduate courses, this was a real concern for Louise, who wanted to make sure that they were going in with both eyes open.
I really encouraged them and pushed them to go to university open days. There will be other constraints on where you choose a university. It may be that you have to live at home, for instance, and that's going to narrow down your choices. So it depends on the geography where you're going to go. But several of them did have the freedom to sort of go anywhere. And I said, well, how are you choosing? And they just sort of said, well, I don't really know. You know, I'm just sort of picking a city and thinking, well, that would be quite nice. You know, but they give no consideration at all to the different curriculum. And I said, I'm going to give you some questions that you need to ask when you go on open days, because this will give you the real information. Only one had gone on an open day. Another one was scheduled to go on an open day, but that's only for one of their choices. And I was surprised at that. I thought that applicants would automatically go round lots of open days, but that group certainly hadn't.
Louise has seen the consequences of that unpreparedness with her own eyes when interviewing applicants for midwifery courses.
I've done days worth of interviews where we haven't accepted a single applicant. Now, that's actually very depressing. And that is largely because, it's not because I don't think the applicants weren't motivated. It was that they were completely unprepared for what an interview would be like.
Just like the NHS, schools are really stretched in terms of resources. So careers education is often just tacked on to someone's existing job. Having Louise's experience on hand has been a real benefit, not just to those would-be students, but to the schools too. Of course, not everyone comes into midwifery straight from school. Earlier this year, the first cohort of midwifery apprentices graduated from the University of Greenwich, drawing on their skills and experience as maternity support workers. And of course, there's also the shortened course for those who are qualified nurses wanting to make the move into midwifery.
Okay, so my name is Shauna McCabe. I am a final year student midwife in Belfast at Queen's University. I'm just about to start my final placement and then I'll be qualified hopefully in the summer. I'm doing the shortened course, so it's for people who were nurses who want to be midwives, and it used to be 18 months, but they've recently changed it to a two-year course and they've changed it from a degree to a master's. So I was actually the first intake of that course. So I was qualified 16 years before I started the course.
Like so many of us, the pandemic made Shauna really think about what she wanted from life and to consider what she wanted to do next.
It was only during COVID that I thought, am I happy? Am I happy in my career? I didn't really feel like I was being challenged anymore. I could do my job with my eyes closed and I felt like I needed a new challenge. And then my boss had sent around one of those generic emails, does anybody want to do this master's in midwifery? And I thought, do you know what? I do. I want to do that. So I didn't think I would get in because so many people I know have done it and loads of people have told me that you have to apply maybe 5-6 times. But I thought, honestly, it's really, really competitive, really hard to get into. There's very few places. And obviously I had no experience of midwifery at all. But I kind of thought, I'll give it a go. I'll try this once. And if it doesn't happen, I'll try one more time. And then I'll forget about it. It wasn't meant to be. Because I really do think that things do happen for a reason. And if I was supposed to do this course, I was going to get onto it. And then I did get onto it. I was kind of a bit like 90% excited and 10% thinking, what have I done? What am I doing? Because it is really hard to, especially when you're so long in your career, it's hard to then go back to the beginning and start all over again. And the last time I was a student, I was 18, you know, like 20 years have passed. And it's kind of different when you're a fully blown adult to go in and be directed and told what to do and, you know, that type of thing.
For Shauna, she had the advantage of knowing what it's like to work in the health service, to understand the pressures, but also understand the benefits of working as part of a team. Even so, she's acutely aware of the difference between nursing and midwifery.
I do feel that midwifery is so, so different from nursing. To me, it's a lot harder. Like academically, you know, there's so much that you need to know that I think when you tell people you're a midwife, they just imagine you're cuddling babies all day. And it's nothing like that at all. If only it was, that would be lovely. But it's all about women and women's health and being with women and supporting them and advocating for them. It's very, very different to nursing. I kind of naively thought, well, I'm a nurse, surely I can do midwifery and it'll be just about the same level. But to me, it's a step up and you really, really, really need to know your stuff. You need to know exactly what you're talking about. You need to be able to plan for all eventualities. There's so much more autonomy. Do you know, it's not the case where you can just lift the phone and ring the doctor. You, of course, the doctors are available if you need them, but like 9 times out of 10, you're the one that's expected to solve the problem or fix whatever's going on. So you constantly need to be thinking a few steps ahead and be thinking, right, this is happening now, but what does this mean? What might happen next? And you have to be ready for everything. And I think it's that, just that autonomy that's different from nursing. That's the biggest difference, I think.
While midwifery might be a step up, the knowledge that Shauna brings with her from nursing is incredibly valuable.
Well, I'll give you an example. I was with the midwife once and she had a delivery that was happening and then there was a shoulder dystocia. and I had never seen one. It was my first ever placement in delivery suite. I thought, right, well, I'll just hang back and watch what happens and see how everything unfolds. And then managed to deliver the baby safely, and that was great. But then the woman dropped her blood pressure and she went unconscious, and everybody was fussing over the baby, and the baby was being, you know, resuscitated and that. But I could recognize this woman is going off here. And I knew it doesn't matter if she's just had a baby or whatever reason she's collapsed, I knew what to do and how to look after her. And if I didn't have my nursing behind me, I probably would have been freaking out and, you know, just standing there going, I don't know what to do. But you just straight away go into nurse mode and you know what to do. And I was able to sort the woman and help the woman out while everybody else was looking after the baby. So I felt like that was the first time I thought, you know what, it's really useful to have nursing. To me, it has been an advantage most of the time. But then there's other things that you do kind of have to unlearn. There's things in midwifery that are very different. For example, like your midwife's exemptions, it's going to be tricky to get my head around the fact that I can just prescribe like right up to paracetamol and give a woman two paracetamol without having to run looking for a doctor to prescribe them.
University programmes have been the bedrock for midwifery education since the late 1990s. But being a midwife is about so much more than what forms a degree. Over recent years, there's been a growing understanding that fresh out of the box midwives need more support to ensure not only that they are successful, but that they stay within the profession. Formal preceptorship programmes for early career midwives are now seen as a fundamental part of midwifery education.
Universities are providing programmes of education, NMC approved programmes that are aligned to the requirements, proficiencies to become a midwife. But for example, in our most recent standards, newborn examination. So we have newborn examination, or NIPE, included in the pre-ed programme. There isn't the infrastructure for that currently for existing practitioners. So actually having that within the standards and expecting that to be achieved was folly and was very short-sighted. Equally, the Lancet framework that the proficiencies or the standards are based upon has been in existence since 2014. I'm not entirely convinced it's embedded in practice yet either. There's lots of noise in the space. And I think if we can try and dampen down that noise in that first year and support our newly graduate midwives who are really vulnerable because they've gone from a very supported system to autonomous practice. And not only that, we've also got this over that first year working towards progressing up a band as well and moving on to band 6 from a band 5, something that we don't have in nursing, something that people are questioning. And I suppose the other challenge we have is that we've got headcount full-time students coming into pre-reg midwifery programmes. We don't get the same output because people don't want to work full-time. So actually our workforce projections are saying, well, we need this number of students, but actually what we're forgetting is we'll get 80% of them in the workforce at the other end. So we're already in deficit, but we can't afford to lose people. And what an investment we've made in people who have said, I want to be a midwife. I want to be a midwife. I want to be with women. I want to be providing that care. And we support that only to lose them because they feel unsupported, they feel unprepared, and everything else going on in that space. Not to mention the scrutiny that maternity care is under just now that is making everybody feel uncomfortable, the reality of practice today.
That was Tom McEwen, newly appointed Fellow of the Royal College of Midwives and Head of Programme and Principal Educator at NHS Education Scotland, or NESS. Tom's role covers everything post-registration. And like Louise, who we heard from earlier, he wants to ensure that new midwives are as prepared as they can be for practice.
One of the things we've recognised is that we probably don't have a consistent approach to preceptorship. And that induction period, that preceptorship, that support, we could improve on that. Fundamentally, the role of the midwife in the 21st century is very different to the role of the midwife in the 20th century. And, you know, although we're only in 2023, I think we would all acknowledge that we are seeing trends where spontaneous vaginal births are probably hovering around about 50% in some areas. Cesarean birth rates are sitting at 30, 35%. So if we think back to what midwifery came from just in the last century, we were seeing much higher spontaneous vaginal births, and the role of the midwife was very different, and the complexity of the women and the birthing people that we care for is so different that actually we probably need to think differently about how we're educating and what we're educating for. And I think because we've got a bit of a mismatch there, it's quite difficult for people to transition into that autonomous practice and the realities. And I think we've also got a habit, and I remember it from being a midwifery lecturer, I was always very conscious that I didn't want to paint the rose-tinted picture of what midwifery practice was, or just rely on their clinical practice and their placements to give them the real picture. You actually have to have those conversations in the academic space as well and build those tools and that ability for people to recognise that it is challenging, but the rewards are huge. And I think if people have got unrealistic expectations that we maybe foster, it's no surprise that they go out into the real world and realise that actually this is not what they were anticipating.
Even for those with plenty of experience of working within the NHS, the transition from being a student to autonomous professional can be hard. Here's Shauna again.
So many people have said to me, you know, doing a course like this is like learning to drive. You'll get your piece of paper to say that you've passed, but then you go off and learn how to do it really. So I'm saying, like, we have an 18-month preceptorship in the trust where I'm going to be working. So I'm sort of saying this as not a 2-year course, but as a 3.5-year course. And I'm going to like use that preceptorship time to continue to develop my skills and get my confidence up with things. Because it's once you're like, when you're a student on a ward, it feels very different to when you're actually a qualified member of staff on that ward, you know. So I'm trying not to be overly daunted by it and just think, take it a day at a time. It will be tough, it will be stressful.
And of course, that pressure isn't only felt by the graduate. There's an impact on existing staff too.
I think that is at the nub of why that preceptorship needs such attention, because we need to manage the expectations of the workforce of who is joining them, and that this is a fresh out the bag midwife. They are highly skilled, highly knowledgeable. They've been assessed to within an inch of their life. They have met all the requirements for registration. So they've got nothing to prove. They're a midwife. But what they need support with is that transition into being that completely accountable, autonomous practitioner. And that's a huge, huge jump. And so the expectations of workforce has to be managed that, you know, you are getting a new person in your team, but you're going to have to nurture them and support them. There's lots of things they can do well, but there'll be some things that they really struggle with because they've not necessarily had that experience. They've not necessarily worked in that particular area or in that environment. They might be unfamiliar with that particular board or trust. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in order to support them to develop into a practitioner that you want them to be and you need them to be, and for them to feel valued and to feel belong. So it's not a difficult thing, but it is difficult when you've got practitioners or workforce who are stretched so incredibly thin, you can't pour from an empty cup. And so effectively, we're asking a lot of them to say, we know that you're knackered. We know that you're up against it from the minute you come on shift to aft. We know that you're thinking about your work when you go home. We know all of that. And we know it seems utterly unreasonable to ask more of you. But honestly, this little bit, if you can do this, it will be beneficial.
While Tom recognises that, particularly now, some staff may see newly qualified midwives as an extra thing to add to their to-do list, he's clear that investing in them has huge benefits.
This is an opportunity to mould and shape someone and give them a sense of belonging and become a future valued colleague. So getting it right from the start and making that person feel, you're going to get so much more engagement from that person if they feel like you're engaged and committed to them, and making them feel part of your tribe, part of your team right from the start. So I mean, it isn't difficult. And I think in the vast majority of cases, that's exactly what's happening. You know, despite all the stress that people are under, I do firmly believe that that is happening. But I think it's difficult to maintain. I think it's one of those things that it's happening, but it's maybe happening for the first few weeks. And then after that, it's right. Training wheels are off. Got no time for this anymore. Let's get stuck in. Actually, that, and I suppose that's where clinical supervision has got a role to play. It's about saying, well, actually, we all need a space to talk. We all need a space to reflect. We all need a space to just recharge a little bit and feel safe to talk and ask questions and not be belittled. And if you develop that kind of culture right from the start, then that's the culture that will happen, and it will be permeate through the whole place. And I'm starting to see it from directors of midwifery and heads of midwifery that are really investing so much in those first few weeks and making themselves visible. And that says to that newly caught, I'm important. I'm valued. I'm important to this organization. They want me here. You know, so just getting that right, but it needs sustained for longer, but it also needs to be individualized. So we need to move away from very prescribed structure. We need it to be, well, speak to that newly qualified practitioner, understand what they feel comfortable with and what are the areas that they feel less confident in, and focus on that rather than just say, well, we're going to put you in labour ward for a couple of months, we're going to put you in community here, we're going to put you here. And actually that's not helpful. It's got to be tailored and individualized.
It's no secret that pretty much everywhere, retention of midwives is a huge challenge. Worryingly, RCM surveys have found that the group most likely to be looking for the door are those in their first 5 years of practice. In Scotland, as in many other parts of the UK, geography can add to those challenges.
We are certainly getting our midwives out of their programme and in employment, but what we're sadly seeing is we're losing many of them often within the first year or within the first couple of years. So there is challenges. So for Scotland, we've got a couple of distinct challenges. We've got a huge remote and rural area in Scotland. So being able to support practitioners and actually grow practitioners and grow midwives in those areas, because our three main areas that we have midwifery education in Scotland is Robert Gordon University, Edinburgh Napier, and the University of West Scotland. So that covers the north, the east, and the west. But obviously they're located in big cities. But the reality is midwifery practices across the mainland, as well as the wealth of space that we have off the land and the islands.
Working in rural and remote areas means you need to be prepared for, well, pretty much anything. And this is where those teams really excel. The focus on skills and drills and of working with other teams is vital.
All of our boards engage with us and we deliver training and education out there, multi-professional, all working together. And that includes things like the ambulance service as well, because they're an integral part of service delivery. And particularly you've got remote and rural and something goes wrong and you need to transfer a woman from a midwife-led unit to a remote and rural into a district general or tertiary centre for care. And what we find is that those that are working in remote and rural practice are the very ones who are very good at maintaining their skills. They're practicing all the time. They're thinking about, well, what scenario could happen? What would we do if? What would we do about that? Who would we contact? So we've actually got quite a good community of practice probably in Scotland, particularly with our remote and rural boards who all work together quite nicely, as well as working with their partner boards that they would refer into for a consultant care. So it's not perfect, but we've certainly got a model in Scotland where our remote and rural services work very hard at managing those situations because they know that they don't have a buzzer they can pull and 20 people are going to come in and save the day. So that is one way we mitigate for that risk. But the reality is, you said that women will give birth anywhere in Scotland. And because we're such a beautiful place, people come on holiday up here and they go to all the beautiful places in Scotland and end up having a baby. And if it's preterm labour or complications, then it is about how we manage that transfer. So we're doing a lot of work in Scotland just now. We've got a Scottish perinatal network, managed clinical network, which has got a maternity arm and a neonatal arm. And they work developing guidance and protocols to help for that very eventuality.
Being ready for literally anything may sound daunting, but it's no different in central and urban areas where there needs to be a mix of skills to meet the needs of women and families. However, those needs are changing and evolving, and services need to evolve with them, no matter where they are.
The other thing that we probably need to have a conversation about nationally is that we're probably not really thinking well enough about maternity services in terms of skill mix. We're working in a model of workforce which is based on our activity and complexity of yesteryear. Whereas actually, if we were to grow and things like the apprenticeship model south of the border, but also our maternity support workers, our maternity care assistants we've got in Scotland, there's a real opportunity to grow that workforce, but totally underutilise them and underappreciate them because people are worried about that's not delegation, it's replacement, and it's not. But if you can grow your workforce more, then it means that our midwives can focus on their midwifery care, and they've got a maternity support worker who's supporting them to provide that women-centred, person-centred care. And it just seems an easy win, but it's trying to go over that. It's not a replacement for midwives. This is a part of our workforce because these are practitioners that know how the system works. They've got that resilience. They've got that savvy, that knowledge that is only really gathered from working. And it's different to being a student in the space, but you're actually employed, you're working in that space. I don't understand why we're not seeing more of that. I really don't understand it. It stumbles me.
As Shauna's experience shows, bringing different perspectives into the maternity workforce can be really valuable. And as Tom says, that workforce is incredibly broad. Someone who's taken her experience of working clinically and applied it to midwifery education is Priti Patel, who I met in Birmingham. But midwifery wasn't necessarily something she'd previously considered.
Midwifery was never on my radar, ever. Yeah, it never crossed my mind when I was at school, college, university even, because I did a biomedical science degree initially. I then became a medical laboratory officer, did that for a year and got sick of inoculating petri dishes and thought, it's not what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I'm quite chatty. So I was like, okay, I'm a people's person. I need to do something with people. So I ended up sort of going to my careers advisor and sort of saying, right, I need a new challenge every day and I need to be working with people and, you know, to learn things new on a daily basis and have an exciting kind of job. So I typed it into the computer and two career paths came out. One was midwifery and the other one was a forensic scientist. And I love crime and whodunit and CSI and all of that. And then I sort of sat and thought about it a little bit. And I thought, no, actually, no, midwifery is probably out of the two. Midwifery is where I want to go. So I sort of fell into it somehow.
For Priti, the unexpected decision to follow the midwifery path felt right. But she experienced some surprising resistance.
But actually, my family were not impressed at all with it because, you know, I come from an Asian background and traditionally it's about you've got to be a doctor, lawyer, engineer, and if you do anything outside of that, you're a failure or you're not academically able. That's how it's perceived. And I think also, because in, you know, my parents, they're and my family, extended family, their experience of midwifery was, well, you know, their grandmothers and their great-grandmothers were, well, not midwives, but birth attendants. And in India, you don't have to be educated to be a birth attendant. It's passed down from generation to generation. So when I told them this is what I was going to do, they were like, you what? You need to go to university and be educated for that? Like, you know, your great-grandmother and their grandmothers all did it. So it was a real fight. I mean, my parents and my family now couldn't be more proud of me now. But it wasn't initially how they felt.
Having worked clinically for many years, Priti particularly enjoyed nurturing other staff and supporting them through their training. But it wasn't until a friend suggested teaching that she even considered it as a career move.
Caring for women and their families was absolutely the core of what I wanted to do, but I wanted to take the profession forward. I wanted to contribute to it a lot more. And I suppose I kept getting feedback from my colleagues and from students going, oh, it's really amazing working with you. You really explain things really well. So you get these little, you know, you're drip fed that, oh, actually, maybe you've got a teaching skill within you that I never really tapped into. So I always thought, oh, I really do enjoy having students with me and teaching them and, you know, explaining. And it's great when you see the light bulb moment, you think, I helped you get there. So it was really great as a a mentor, which is what they were back in the day. Now they're practice supervisors and practice assessors. So I did that, and then I was pregnant with my third child, and I remember going through this sort of turmoil as a professional, thinking, well, I've done what I want to do as a midwife, and I love it and all the rest of it, but I'm ready to now want to make things better, make a change. And it was just really frustrating, I think, on the shop floor, as, you know, midwives probably now feel. So I think when I became pregnant then with my third child and I was going on maternity leave, there's a little part of me that I was so frustrated at that point that I just thought, I'm not sure I want to come back to this profession, really, because I don't think I can carry on doing what I'm doing, and I can't see a way forward past it because there's too many obstacles in my way to do what I want to do. And then one of my friends, that my colleagues that I was working with, she goes, you know, you can't leave the profession, you've got to stay in the profession. So she sort of said, what about teaching? A post had come out to be a facilitator in the education team. So she goes, oh, you should go for that, that'd be really great, because then you can, you know, teach qualified staff and students. So she started the application, and actually it's through that I thought, okay, well, she did pretty much everything until to the point where I had to sort of submit. So I submitted it and I went for an interview, and of course I got the job because I was half in it. I was sort of went, I thought, I'll turn up and see how it goes, and obviously I got the job, and that was my first step into education. And it sort of just brought, so I went and had my baby, came back into the new role, and it sort of just brought me back alive and reminded me why I'd come into this.
Now a lead midwife for education at the University of Greenwich, her family's reaction to her career choice is way in the past. Perhaps it's that early experience that meant that, until relatively recently, she didn't challenge the lack of diversity in midwifery.
Really weird to say this, and might sound really weird actually, but it's only now that I've come to the realization that, hold on, actually, yeah, there was nobody that looked like me. You know, even in my cohorts, there wasn't many sort of Asians. Even now, when you look around the LME pool, there is no other Asian LME, and I think there's only two of us of colour in the whole LME. But again, hadn't really occurred to me until now. It's all brought to the forefront, and you go back and think, actually, yeah. But I don't know if that subconsciously was because I already knew coming into the profession when I chose to come in that it's not a chosen Asian pathway to go down. So I guess I knew I was one, you know, sort of the odd one out from the beginning by making that decision. Yeah, sort of just grow to accept it, I guess. And it's only now that I realise actually that was, yeah, it was very evident now I reflect on it.
But it wasn't just the lack of diversity in her cohort at university or in practice.
I don't know whether that's just because it's just ingrained. You just don't expect to see, reflect, you know, a reflection of yourself in these, because it's not been around for so long. I think now it's changing for sure. I mean, our students will say now, and actually, you know, we do have models in different skin tones virtually. When we're using platforms, there's virtual sort of skin tones. When we purchase models, we now have purchased lots of different skin tones, so that's definitely reflective. But actually, when it first came about, I remember students going, oh, we've got a brown baby, oh, we've got a black baby, and like it was a shock, because, and it was a shock, of course, but it should never have been that.
Recognizing the need for change is the first step, but only the first step. At the conference in Birmingham, the RCM unveiled its groundbreaking new toolkit designed to help decolonise midwifery, starting at university. One of those taking part in the project alongside Pretty was Maxine Chapman, a midwifery lecturer at the University of Leicester, who I also caught up with in Birmingham.
I think what it was about the project is having the lived experience of having discrimination, not seeing myself in the curriculum, not seeing myself in practice, looking at the educational materials that I used as an educator since 2015 when I left clinical practice and came into education. I knew I was missing in that kind of literature, that landscape. And I was there, it almost felt lonely at times, just people perhaps not understanding the challenges of delivering a curriculum where I wasn't represented, and most of the students in front of me were not represented.
One of those students was Selina Palmer, who's now in her final year at Leicester.
Well, basically, when I was applying, I was told by my careers advisor that I'd either get into midwifery because I'm black, or I wouldn't get into midwifery because I'm black. So from that sort of angle, I was sort of a bit wary of whether I'd even get into midwifery in the first place. So sort of getting here, I was sort of under the impression that things may not be how I assumed it to be. At the start of my school, when I was sort of thinking about what career path I want to go down. So I was always under the impression that it wasn't going to be all sunshine and roses, and unfortunately. I had a few bad experiences in the first year, which at that point I didn't really have the confidence to speak up about and escalate concerns and things like that. But from then on, after that year, I sort of made a decision within myself that I wasn't going to stay quiet about things, and I was going to take on an active role to sort of be the voice. To me, I've always wanted to be a midwife, so I wasn't really going to let anything get in the way of that. Got really supportive parents as well. I just had to just think to myself, like, you've got to get through this, basically. So you can't be another one of the statistics who's, like, dropped out of uni and, you know, like, I really wanted to make something for myself. And that, in a way, it sort of turned me the other way. So it didn't sort of bring me down. It sort of spurred me to do more with myself and try and get involved in as much as possible. So yeah, that's sort of how I overcame that.
Selena's confidence has grown over her time as a student. And that confidence to speak out is admirable. And it's something that Pretty hopes that the new toolkit will give others too.
What I think this toolkit, and I'm hoping it will do, is give educators the confidence and students the confidence to speak out where we've been silent for so long. That actually, when they do see there isn't something that's reflecting, whether it's resources, you know, online or face-to-face, or teaching or reading lists or anything that's not quite reflecting them, that this, you know, the toolkit will give us that insight and confidence to be able to say, okay, we need to do something about it. And I think, to be fair, talking about my own team and colleagues that I talk to in education, I think everyone's at a place at the moment that want to do it. But I think what the toolkit will do, and I'm hoping will do, is give people the confidence, because I don't think people got the confidence. They want to do it, but they don't know how to. And that's exactly what this toolkit needs to provide. And it's not about giving the answers, but it's about just asking the right questions to get people thinking.
Maxine has high aspirations for the toolkit as well.
I think for me, it's about embedding this into the professional regulatory standards for education. So with the NMC, actually making it mandatory for universities to have this as part of the requirement for education of midwives. So it's great we've got this toolkit, but yeah, we need it to have greater impact and people to be accountable for what we teach and how we teach it. And I think the toolkit really is a great framework for the NMC to adopt, is where that's my vision for it.
While there's been some progress in decolonising the midwifery curriculum, including the introduction of models to show different skin tones, this is the first time a Royal College has taken the lead. And that's something Pretty feels is really important.
People do stand up and take notice when the RCM have put a publication out. And it's not something that the RCM just do locally. There's lots of stakeholder input from lots of different levels and, you know, across the four countries. The net is cast wide and, you know, there's a lot of sort of oomph behind it. And I think that's why it's important that the RCM develops this and led on this, because it also shows that they are behind what the educators want. Just gives that sort of that credibility. I think what I'm hoping this toolkit will do is give me the welly I need to go to higher levels to sort of say, right, we've got a toolkit that's you know, nationally recognised, and look, this is what it's talking about and this is how it's going to have an impact. It's in black and white. It's not just some little document we put together as a team. You've got to stand up and notice it. And I think it will just give organisations and educators a little bit of welly with their executive team to say, right, we've got to listen to this and let's see if we can support it.
The toolkit doesn't just focus on the curriculum itself, but also on the differing needs of those students who come from Black, Asian or other ethnic backgrounds. This is something that Pretty feels has previously been overlooked and has led some students to drop out of university altogether.
students who were not successful and were withdrawn ultimately from the program, when I then met with them afterwards, they always had extenuating circumstances. And when I then said to them, why did you not apply for this support and that support? They then said culturally, it was very evident, culturally it just wasn't acceptable. Certain cultures don't go to DDS because it's a sign of weakness. It's a sign of failing. It's a sign of saying, I can't cope. And, you know, the family sort of look down and you think, you know, you're weak if you can't do this. What do you need to go to DDS for? What, you know, what's dyslexia? That means something's not right with you. So that puts people off. So I'm working at the moment in my organization to work with that team and the executive team to say, what are we doing to show students of color that it's okay that you can access this? And actually, you know, show them students who look like them and feel like them that they've accessed it and where, how far they've come, and show them that it's okay to do that. Just having a service isn't enough. You've got to target these people and think the background that they've come from. And I think that's where it's going to be really helpful, sort of highlight and strengthen those little areas that already exist, but not for the people we're trying to target.
Priti doesn't deny that this is a tricky area for some, particularly for those working in education.
I think for academics, it's a particular challenge because as academics, we are so used to knowing everything and having the expectation that we know everything. So you stand in front of a class and the students look at you like you have all the answers and you are not allowed to say, I don't know. And you almost, as an academic, you almost feel like a failure if you can't answer a question, whether it's about midwifery. You can't, you know, if you can't answer a question in a class, you almost feel like you feel a bit fidgety going, oh my God, I can't answer that, and trying to quickly Google it so you can get an answer out to them so you don't lose face. And so when it comes to things like this, we are completely out of our comfort zone. And therefore, the academic's natural response is to run away from it. And I think the first thing is accepting it's okay. You're not incompetent. It's just such a changing platform and everyone's learning together. And it's okay not to know. And it's okay to let the students know you don't know. And I think that's what it's about. And that's the biggest challenge, I think.
For Maxine, this project has the potential to bring about real change.
Thinking about my grandparents, particularly my grandmother, she was part of the Windrush generation. So she came to the UK and practiced as a nurse, enrolled nurse. But that was it. She couldn't go any further than that. That was just, you're an enrolled nurse. You'd come to serve in the UK. And yeah, and look where we are a few generations on, but you're the next generation. But, you know, looking back, you know, those brilliant women that have gone before, stayed in the profession, didn't give up, but yeah, I just feel like there's so much we can do now, the opportunity for the global majority to make real impact and level things up. That's the vision, that it will be the very beginning of a massive change that needs to happen.
There's a saying that's often trotted out, be the change you want to see. But in reality, that's often easier said than done. But what's important is that we try and that we keep trying. And that's what education is. It's learning by doing, learning from experience, not just from what goes right, but maybe more importantly, from what goes wrong too. We learn and we apply that learning and we move forward. You can find out more about the Decolonising Midwifery Toolkit and the support that the RCM has available for students and early career midwives at our website, rcm.org.uk. That's where you'll also find our e-learning package, iLearn, which has plenty of modules to support your continuing professional development. And don't forget, all the previous episodes of the podcast are still available wherever you get your podcasts. So until next time, I'm Jo Tanner, and thank you for listening.